Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the former chair of the New York Film Critics Circle and National Society of Film Critics, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films are The Contestant, Remembering Gene Wilder, and Seven Samurai.
I'd like to start out by talking about a couple of documentaries, and they are very, very different from each other, I must say. And the first one is by far the more interesting of the two. It's called The Contestant. And it is a British film written and directed by Claire Titley. It's a documentary. It's a nonfiction film. And, oh, I wish it were fiction, because the subject matter of it is just so it really got to me. It's not pleasant, let us say. So the main character, the subject, the person who is right at the center of this nonfiction film is a person who is known as Nasibi. That's not his real name, but he wanted to be a comedian. And so he took that name as kind of his nickname. It means eggplant. It's a Japanese term meaning eggplant. And he took that name because he's kind of a funny-looking guy. He has a very, very long and narrow face, and some people said his face was shaped like an eggplant. And he sort of embraced that, and he made that his nickname as a performer. So there he is. He's a young man. As a child, he was bullied a lot in school because of his funny looks and so forth. And so he discovered that he could kind of defuse situations by making people laugh. And so he's always enjoyed making people laugh. That's what he wants to do. So he's not really getting anywhere as a comedian, and he's still quite a young man. But then he gets approached by a reality television producer. Now, this is before reality television was a thing. All this takes place back in the late 1990s. So basically, we're in about 1998 when this happened. This person comes to him and says, I have an idea for a TV show and you can be in it. However, Nasibi, I will call him by that, his nickname, he isn't sure what all this is about, but he agrees that he will do it. He knows it's going to be some kind of a challenge. Well, what happens is that the producer and some others literally put a blindfold on him, put a mask over his eyes so he can't see, put earphones over his ears so he can't hear, and take him someplace. And where they're taking him to turns out to be an apartment. And in the apartment, there are a few basic needs of life, but he is then made to take off all of his clothes, and he is told that he will get nothing to eat, nothing to wear, nothing, unless he wins it as a prize. And there in the apartment, in this small little room, really, are these enormous amounts of magazines. And what his challenge is to go through the magazines and enter every single little prize contest that there is and hope that he wins things. Now, of course, the producers are not going to let him starve to death if this doesn't go well, but that's about it. They're willing to give him a little bit of bread, a little bit of rice to keep him alive. But other than that, he has got to win stuff. And the whole challenge will not end until he has won 1 million yen worth of prizes. And of course, he will be using these prizes along the way. Now, 1 million yen, the way I figure it, is roughly maybe in today's dollars, about $7,000. So that's it. So all this is real. And all of this is going to be broadcast. Now, he is told that only a little bit of it will be broadcast. They can't have him shown 24 hours a day. But actually, they are broadcasting a very large amount of this live. Then they start live streaming it so that he is always being live streamed, always. And they come up with a little eggplant sort of emoji that they move around so that his private parts will not be visible because of censorship concerns. But aside from that, he is just completely on his own. This is a horrible thing. And this goes on for almost a year. To my mind, it looks like real torture that this poor guy is being put through. Now, again, he had an unusual early life in certain respects. He was bullied as a child and so forth, and he seems to be a person who enjoys a challenge. But, it just seems to me the most horrible thing to put anybody through. Now, we all know that some reality TV shows, that's what they do. They put a person or people through horrible experiences, and we get to gaze at them and ogle them and just be voyeurs on them. And that is very much what is happening here. Now, something else that Nasibi doesn't know, however, is that the stuff being broadcast and live streamed makes him into an astonishingly popular celebrity in Japan. People are watching him, young people especially, they love it. They watch him, they follow his exploits, they cheer when he wins something. But he doesn't know about any of this because he is completely cut off from the outside world. Finally, I won't really tell what happens here, but finally the challenge does come to an end, and then, in a weird sort of a way, it starts all over again. So, watching this movie, The Contestant, and that's very much what it's about, he's a contestant, made me very uncomfortable. I think it's very important that we know things like this go on in the world and go on in the entertainment world, and I guess particularly maybe in the Japanese entertainment world, although similar things have certainly happened in plenty of other countries. But I just found the whole thing to be just as a spectacle, something that tells something about modern society, modern culture. It's just very, very discomforting. The fact that jillions of people were willing and eager to watch this poor guy go through all of this stuff, and the poor guy himself, well, anyway, I found the whole thing very revealing. Again, not just about him, but about aspects of our modern culture, which I think are very unfortunate and that we should all be giving a lot of thought to as much as we possibly can. Again, the outcome is okay for him. Believe it or not, the climax of the movie, the end of the movie, takes place on Mount Everest. Won't give that away. And he seems to be a very, very resilient guy, this Nasibi. And I hope he is well out there somewhere right now. But I found the movie to be revealing. I think people ought to watch it, but I also found it very, very uncomfortable. And for that reason, also, people ought to watch it. We need to be made uncomfortable if things like this are going on in today's 21st century and late 20th century culture. Okay, now for something much more comforting and much more familiar. Remembering Gene Wilder. This is a new movie directed by Ron Frank, and yep, it's about the late, and many people would say, great Gene Wilder. There was a recent tribute movie to a person who isn't dead, Albert Brooks, and I rather like Albert Brooks's work as a filmmaker and a comedian, and I didn't much like that documentary. I just found it really never got to me. I didn't even find it very funny, even when they were showing Albert Brooks. This movie, Remembering Gene Wilder, he died not too many years ago, and the movie is a memorial to him. And again, I found it not very funny, even though Gene Wilder was basically a comic actor, but it was fun to watch, and it certainly brought back a lot of instant nostalgia for me, and I'm sure that will go for a lot of other people as well. So Gene Wilder, rather like Nasibi in Japan, when he was very young, he discovered that it was good to make people laugh. In fact, his mother had a very serious heart condition. This is an interesting thing that I learned from the movie. And at one point, his mother's physician took little Gene Wilder, a little boy, took him aside and said, "Don't ever argue with your mother and try to make her laugh." Well, that's quite a tall order to give a very little kid, "Don't ever argue with your mother." But he did his best to do that because he knew that it involved her health. And he also decided that he was going to try to make her laugh. And then he discovered he could make other people laugh as well. Now, like a lot of people who become famous performers, Gene Wilder is obviously a very creative person. We find out in the course of the movie that he's apparently quite a gifted painter. We see a little bit of his work along those lines. And he's also a writer and director. He wrote Young Frankenstein, one of his most popular movies that he also starred in. And he wrote and directed The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother, and other films after that. So he's a really versatile and extremely creative person, and this movie gets into all of that. But of course, what it focuses on mainly is his comic acting. Near the very beginning, one of his colleagues who is remembering him says he was really just an actor who was very good at doing comic acting, and I think that's a fair assessment. He's not just a comedian who turned actor. He's an actor who had a special gift for comedy. Now, the first time Gene Wilder ever made a big impression on me was in the movie Bonnie and Clyde, where he plays a tiny little role And it's a very memorable role. And when I see the movie in more recent years, he's really good in it. He's doing his Gene Wilder stuff, but he's just exactly cast correctly in that movie. And the way he got that movie was, the way he got the role, was that the director saw him and said, that's him. That's the guy to play this little role. Well, this kind of thing apparently happens a number of times in Gene Wilder's early career. That, for example, is also how he got cast in his first really big movie, The Producers, Mel Brooks's famous movie from many, many years ago, where they were looking about for somebody to play the sort of second lead role. The first lead role had already been cast with Zero Mostel, and Zero Mostel had approval over whoever was going to play the second big role. And apparently the moment Zero Mostel got a look at Gene Wilder, he said, that's the guy. So sometimes people seem to cast Gene Wilder in his early roles almost on instinct, and it seemed to pay off. So we get a whole lot of clips from The Producers. For people who don't remember The Producers, it's a Mel Brooks movie, and it's about a couple of producers who set out to make a stage play, a stage musical, that will deliberately be a flop so they can rip off their investors. And the musical is called Springtime for Hitler. And then, of course, the movie turns into a huge hit, and the scheme goes wrong, and so forth and so on. So anyway, that was the movie that made Gene Wilder into a star. And then, of course, many, many other movies followed, including movies that he wrote and directed himself, such as The Adventure of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother and some other things. So we see all of that in this movie, and we get sort of a guided tour through Gene Wilder's career. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory plays a very big role in this movie. We see a lot of clips from that. Also Young Frankenstein, of course, and other famous movies. Now, I have to say, a lot of these movies were made by Mel Brooks. I have never really been an admirer of Mel Brooks. I find his movies to be loud and vulgar and often not very funny. I'm in a minority on that. Mel Brooks has been a gigantically popular filmmaker over the years. So I'm in a minority, and I didn't change my mind watching Remembering Gene Wilder. There are clips from The Producers, a huge hit way back in 1967, made a big star of Gene Wilder. It's mainly a lot of people shouting at each other. In Young Frankenstein, there's too much people shouting at each other. So that's kind of the way it goes. And this movie did not, the new movie did not change my mind about those old movies. It was kind of interesting to see the clips from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and to be reminded that that movie was not a hit when it came out. And poor Gene Wilder back in 1971 was wondering if he was really going to have a career at all. But of course, he did have a very major career, and it was partly his own making. Again, he wrote Young Frankenstein. He wrote and directed some movies after that. The movie also very interestingly gets into his collaborations with other people, his wife, Gilda Radner, for example, who died all too early, and also Richard Pryor. He had a wonderful rapport with Richard Pryor. They had a really good on-screen partnership in just a few movies, but it really worked for the two of them. And we also then get reminded about Richard Pryor's drug use and so forth. So there are interesting and very serious footnotes in this movie. Overall, Remembering Gene Wilder did not make me more of a Gene Wilder admirer than it was before. I'm always kind of skeptical. I don't think he was great as an actor or great as a comic actor. But he's hugely popular. So many people do love him, and those people will have a wonderful time remembering him through Remembering Gene Wilder. I actually spoke with him more than once, did a lengthy interview with him at one point. Nice guy, smart guy, not the greatest actor in the world, but Remembering Gene Wilder makes a good case for him. And finally, I would like to touch on briefly a movie from way back in the 1950s, Seven Samurai. Yes, the great Japanese classic by the great Japanese director Akira Kurosawa. Came out in 1954, and it's back. It's been restored digitally in great-looking 4K resolution, and it's returning to theaters. And if it's not playing at a theater near you, just be reminded that this movie exists. It's very, very easily available through streaming and home video and whatnot. And now in the new 4K edition, it's going to look better than ever. And it's just a really worthwhile movie and a hugely influential movie. And I just want to remind everybody that it exists and that it's sort of back on the scene at the moment. So Seven Samurai tells a very basic sort of a story. It's a very long movie, by the way, more than 3 hours long. But the story is basically about a village in medieval Japan where the people are being preyed upon by robbers and bandits and burglars, and their lives are being made miserable. So they hire an unemployed samurai warrior to protect them, and he hires six other samurai warriors to work with him and fight against the bandits and defend the helpless residents of this little village. And that's what the movie's about. So yeah, it has a lot of sword fighting in it, has a lot of drama in it, has a lot of characterizations of interesting peasants in it, and it's just a good all-around movie, quite fascinating. It's also a hugely influential movie, not only Seven Samurai itself, but the samurai genre in particular. The Japanese name for the genre of samurai action movies is Jidaigeki. And remember the Star Wars movies. What are the knights called in that? The Jedi. Sounds like Jidaigeki. And what do? They run around waving lightsabers at each other, almost like samurai swords. So among many other influences, Seven Samurai was clearly a very big influence and inspiration for George Lucas and the whole Star Wars trilogy. Anyway, it's a terrific movie. I recommend it. It's back on the scene. If you can't find it at a movie theater, stream it, have a look at it. It's fun. It's full of action. And it will just leave you breathless probably by the end. So that is my somewhat documentary, somewhat ancient Japanese story this week.
For which we thank you as ever and always, David Sterrett, Films in Focus. The films The Contestant, Remembering Gene Wilder, and Seven Samurai.
Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.